diversity advancement. Our history books are littered with diseases and viruses that have claimed millions of lives: polio, smallpox, and yellow fever, to name just three. And in each case, it was a vaccine that either eradicated the disease or essentially removed it from being a deadly threat in most parts of the world. And almost from the moment COVID-19 entered our vocabularies and our consciousness, scientists around the world have been working around the clock to develop a new vaccine that would offer all of us immunity from this coronavirus, and perhaps return our world to some semblance of normalcy. On today's webcast, we sit down with two professors from McGill's Faculty of Medicine to understand how vaccines work, how quickly we might get our hands on a coronavirus vaccine, and what sorts of logistical and bioethical challenges are facing the medical community as it looks to accelerate clinical trials, vaccine production, and distribution. It's Thursday, June 11th, and in this week's McGill Alumni webcast, A Shot in the Dark, The Search for a Safe and Effective Vaccine, we'll hear from two of the world's leading experts. Let me quickly introduce them. Dr. Brian Ward is a professor in the Department of Medicine's Division of Experimental Medicine, director of the MUHC Vaccine Study Center, and a medical officer at Medicago, a world leader in plant-based vaccine manufacturing. Welcome, Dr. Ward.
Thank you.
And Dr. Jonathan Kimmelman is the James McGill Professor and Interim Director of the Division of Ethics and Policy in McGill School of Population and Global Health. Welcome to both of you, and thank you so much for taking time out of your extremely busy schedules to share some insights on this really important subject. We did receive many questions from alumni, and we'll get to some of them shortly. If you do have a question, you can send it to us by email at aoc@mcgill.ca, and we'll try to add it to our list. But before we jump into those questions and the many that I have around vaccines, I'd like to ask each of you about your current work at McGill and how it relates to COVID-19. Dr. Ward, let's start with you. As one of the country's leading authorities on vaccines, I imagine these must be particularly busy times for you. Can you tell us a little bit about what your professional life has been like during this pandemic and what has been your main area of focus?
Well, like everyone else, the SARS outbreak has caused enormous disruption for me as a professor at McGill. I run a lab and I run the Vaccine Study Center. And it's also basically shut down the ability to move to the office. I spend half of my time in Quebec City at Medicago's office. And I've been blocked from going to the office since mid-March. So my life is lived, like most other people's right now, online and often alone, isolated.
Great. Now, I know that the media and people in my profession can be unrelenting at times. So how have you managed to balance your work commitments with all of the media and speaking requests you must be receiving?
Well, you have to take part, I think. You have to participate in communicating, particularly around vaccines, how to use them. Miscommunications can be disastrous. I think it's part of the responsibility of anybody who's working towards developing vaccines or therapeutics, preventative strategies, to accept at least some of the requests for interviews and for talks. And so I've been doing, I hope, what would be my share.
Great. And we certainly appreciate you taking this time out today to speak to us and to our McGill alumni all over the world, again, on this really important topic. Dr. Kimmelman, so in preparing for today's conversation, I noticed that your teams have been the recipients of two recent grants from McGill's newly launched MI4 Emergency COVID-19 Research Fund. And this support is enabling you to look in part at how public perceptions of vaccine success rates and timelines square with might actually be taking shape in our scientific laboratories. Can you share with us more precisely what these projects are aiming to study and why this should matter to all of us during this pandemic?
Sure. So I'm a bioethicist, but I'm actually trained as a bench scientist. So I run my research group sort of like a lab, the way a basic science researcher would run a lab. So I've got about 12 people in my group, and a lot of what we do is empirical studies of the process of drug development. And since COVID-19, we have also allocated some of our effort and these funding, these new grants actually reflect that, towards trying to understand better the process of vaccine development. So we've got sort of two projects on the go right now. One of them is looking at the success rate of advancement of new vaccine candidates as they go from phase two testing, which is the first time you test for efficacy, through to regulatory licensure, like FDA approval. So that project's now pretty much complete. The second project we're doing is actually with Brian, and it's a project that is looking at the predictions about when new forecasts, new vaccine candidates and new diagnostic technologies will be ready for prime time. And so what we're doing there is we're serving a group of experts, and we're also serving a random sample of members of the public. And one of the things we want to see there is when experts think that vaccines and diagnostics are going to be available for deployment. And number two, we want to look at whether or not those views are well aligned with the perceptions of members of the public. And if they are misaligned with the public, which groups within the public tend to have greater misalignment.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I think we'll have a chance to explore that a little bit more in depth today, because there's certainly some perceptions out there about how quickly the vaccine will be ready. And if you look at history, I think those are maybe a bit optimistic. So we'll see. So Dr. Ward, let me direct the first next couple of questions to you, if I may. This first one might seem a bit elementary, but can you tell us, you know, how do vaccines actually work? And take us through some of the steps that scientists would need to follow once the search for a new vaccine gets underway.
Well, so vaccines are used to prevent more serious consequences of the natural disease that they're designed to protect you against. So there are many different forms of vaccines, live attenuated organisms, inactivated bits and pieces of those organisms. But the whole intent is to expose you to proteins and sugar molecules of an organism that your immune system can use to develop an immune response to in advance of being exposed to the natural disease. And so when you do, if you do see that natural disease, you will then be better prepared to respond and respond quickly. In some cases, a vaccine can provide what's called sterile immunity, where if you're exposed to the disease, it doesn't even get a foothold, so you're completely protected. And in other cases, you have either partial immunity, where you become infected, but you don't become really sick, or even that you just are less sick than you would otherwise have been. And so different vaccines work in slightly different ways, but each of them is simply an early warning system for your immune system, so that you can be better prepared if you encounter the real disease.
Mm-hmm. So in the case of the current coronavirus vaccine search that we're seeing, what would sort of scientists be doing, like, you know, as soon as they start this work, what are the first couple of things they need to do to get on the road to developing the vaccine?
Well, we were lucky with the coronavirus vaccines, because we had the warning from the first SARS that circulated a number of years ago. And then the second scare was the MERS, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. And because of those two outbreaks, there was a concerted effort around the world to try to develop vaccines for those kinds of organism, that family of coronaviruses. And in fact, there were four groups in the world that were working already to develop MERS-type vaccines. And as soon as this new coronavirus, SARS-2, came around, funding agencies were able to turn to those groups and say, are you able to convert the work that you're doing, the animal models, these other things, from MERS to this new SARS-2? And of course, those groups said, yes, we'll do that. And since then, a further about 120 groups around the world have said, we're going to try to do this too, including the company that I work with in Quebec City, Medicago.
Great. So that sounds fairly encouraging if you look at compared to sort of the historical timelines that it takes to develop a vaccine from scratch. It sounds like we're not actually starting from scratch. So let me ask you this question. I'm sure everybody's wondering, where are we in the progress towards a vaccine for the coronavirus? And are those initial estimates of 12 to 18 months that we keep hearing over and over, are they accurate, or is it still too early to tell?
I think it's actually quite accurate. It's both fascinating and a little bit frightening how quickly things are moving. As you said, you alluded to the fact that it normally takes many years to develop a vaccine. And I think prior to this SARS coronavirus outbreak, the record would probably go to the development of a rotavirus vaccine, which took about 3.5 years from conception to being licensed in some countries. I think we are going to see emergency use authorization for probably more than one vaccine before the end of this year, which means that first responders, those people at very elevated risk, but not necessarily the elderly and those with comorbidities. So perhaps school teachers, elementary school teachers, frontline workers might start to be offered vaccines as early as the end of this year. And then very rapidly, the rollout of several of the other vaccines for more general use and eventually for global use.
Great. So I do want to come back to those issues of manufacturing the vaccine and, of course, distributing it and getting it out to patients. But let's bring in Dr. Kimmelman on this question of the timelines that you talked about. And you know, 12 to 18 months is considered by many to still be an accelerated timeline. And you know, of course, it would be the record, I guess, for the quickest production development of a vaccine. So in your from your perspective, Dr. Kimmelman, as a biomedical ethicist, does this ring any warning bells for you? You know, someone who's obviously concerned first and foremost with safety and efficiency of the medications that we take. And what are the risks if we were to rush things along too quickly?
So, yeah, of course, it raises some concerns, you know, and we've already gotten a bit of a preview of some of the concerns because we've seen a lot of the testing for various therapeutics and other kinds of prophylactic strategies stumble on the science. So people here have probably heard about some of the various, you know, missteps in testing hydroxychloroquine, remdesivir, et cetera. So there are a number of sort of challenges that you encounter. Number one, you know, merely because we have a pandemic doesn't mean that we think faster now than we did before. It takes a while to sort of figure out the science, and it's really sort of hard to rush that process along. Number two, there are any number of different political pressures that have often moved the science faster than it can really necessarily support. So I think, you know, I think these are all sort of, you know, major challenges. And I guess the question is whether or not the world of vaccine development will have actually, you know, profited from some of the lessons we've learned in testing some of the early prophylactic and treatment strategies. I guess the third thing that I think is really important to mention is that, you know, if we get a vaccine approved, if we deploy it, we actually don't know very much about safety early on. You know, typically when drugs are developed, this is a little bit different than vaccines, but typically they might be tested in anywhere from 10,000 to 30,000 patients. And that actually doesn't give us very much statistical power to detect, you know, rare but serious adverse events. With vaccines, often you have a much larger sample of population that's exposed before a product is licensed, but there's still a lot to be learned about safety. So I think for me, one of the key issues is making sure that if we get licensed vaccines early on, that those licensures are coupled to really, really good, effective programs of pharmacovigilance, so you can continue to follow the safety issues as the vaccine is deployed in more diverse and larger populations.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know, obviously, medical history is full of mistakes and missteps. I'm thinking of thalidomide, for example, as a famous case where a medication got out before it should have or before side effects were studied. So, I mean, what sort of government measures are in place in countries around the world to protect us from these sorts of mistakes that we've seen in the past? And how can we be assured that even in this case, when there's a pandemic and there's obviously a rush to get a medical solution, that, you know, everything from clinical trials to follow-ups are going to be done safely and efficiently?
Well, every, you know, major country has a regulatory system that is vetting the quality of the efficacy and the safety evidence before they're granting a regulatory approval. And these countries also, including Canada, have systems for post-marketing pharmacovigilance, you know, after you approve, monitoring the safety of interventions. And so I think that, you know, one of the key things we want to make sure is in place is a really robust regulatory system to oversee both the evaluation of vaccines before they're deployed, but also continued safety monitoring. In the US, at least, the FDA has authority to withdraw vaccines or drugs if there are major safety issues that are identified. That happens about for 1% of drugs, 1% to 2% in the US. It also has authority to put warning labels on new drugs and vaccines. About 20% to 30% of new drugs and vaccines will get a warning label about a safety issue that's discovered after the drug or vaccine is deployed in a population. So I think those are some of the kinds of measures that that are really important to make sure that they're in place and that these regulatory agencies are functioning properly.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Ward, let me just bring you in on that question, if you don't mind, as sort of more involved in the vaccine production and development. What are your thoughts or concerns? Are they more acute this time around because of the, call it political or societal pressures to get to a solution quickly?
Well, you don't even have to go to political or societal. You just have to stick with numerical. We have never tried to vaccinate 7.8 billion people before. And that's what we're setting out to do. Even the giant companies that are moving towards the production of a vaccine are talking about producing 1 billion doses. And typically these vaccines are going to be given in two doses. So that means that even the monster companies out there, the very large companies, are talking about protecting potentially 500 million people. And that's in a year. That's production in a year. And so we're not looking, everyone's talking about the vaccine or a vaccine. There will be many vaccines, some of which will be very different from the others, and a couple of which will be very different from any vaccine we've ever used before at scale. And so we are moving into, I think, a very large, medically and fascinating, and I guess from society point of view and bioethics point of view, a really fascinating massive experiment, which is forced by the conditions of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. So let me just stick with you for a minute, Dr. Ward. Just getting back to sort of the progress that we're making, and it seems as sort of a lay observer who just sort of follows and reads the news like I am, that every few days we hear promising reports coming out of various laboratories somewhere in the world. You know, monkeys are showing encouraging signs of immunity, presidents start tweeting, the stock markets go up, although definitely not today, and then we don't hear anything more. So what signs are you looking for as sort of a trained medical observer that would indicate real and significant progress in some of these laboratories?
We are absolutely seeing steady progress. And yes, I think a number of companies are, maybe all companies are using this opportunity, not just companies, but academic groups as well, to announce each small advance that they make. In some cases, that's because that encourages funding of their research or the development of their vaccine. And that's quite understandable as well. But if you actually look at some of the vaccine trackers, the WHO has a very good one. We've seen the progress go from one company or two companies in the earliest phase, the so-called first in human or phase one studies. As of today, we're up to 10. Four of those companies have moved into the later phase studies, the so-called phase two and three, where you look at, you can start to get some idea of safety and eventually efficacy. And as Jonathan pointed out, the phase one studies are very small, a few hundred people. Phase two studies, several, many hundreds of people. Phase two, three studies, we start talking about thousands of people, 5, 10, 15,000. That's not enough yet to identify rare adverse events, rare problems, but it does start to give you enough statistical power to identify problems that are more common. So the first companies that are moving into that phase two, three are going to be starting those studies in the next several months. And then I think very rapidly in the new year, we will see probably more than a dozen, possibly as many as 20 companies moving into those later phase studies. And as I said at the beginning, we're not going to have a single vaccine. We will need many vaccines to actually resolve this problem.
Mm, great. So you mentioned clinical trials and we're moving in that direction. Let me turn back to you, Dr. Kimmelman. I know that's obviously a big area, big focus of your research. Let's talk a little bit about human clinical trials, the role they play in the development of vaccines. So how are these being set up and what are the risks for volunteers who essentially step up and agree to be part of these trials? Are there any additional risks for these subjects this time around because of some of the time pressures?
So anytime you're going to test a drug or a vaccine, you have to test it in patients. And obviously that's ethically fraught. It's one thing to test something in rocks or do basic science in molecules or yeast, but it's another thing to do it in patients. There's sort of broadly two types of clinical studies, healthy volunteer studies. These are typically phase one studies where you have individuals who have no health conditions and they volunteer to, take a bunch of blood draws and incur some discomfort in order to test the safety of an intervention. And then the other category are studies where patients are getting something that is believed potentially be beneficial to them. They have kind of a therapeutic quality to them. And there's a principle called clinical equipoise that is meant to make sure to establish that if patients go into those kinds of studies, that patients are getting an intervention that is believed to be competitive in terms of risk-benefit to what they would receive if they didn't go into the study at all. So the kinds of large randomized trials that we would need to establish the safety and efficacy of a vaccine would typically enroll healthy people, but there would need to be a judgment based on the prior phase two or phase one evidence that the risk-benefit associated with getting the vaccine is comparable, maybe even better, but comparable at least to the risk-benefit of these individuals not receiving a vaccination at all. And so really, again, the vast majority of the trials that are going to be run or people that are going to be enrolled in trials are going to be in those latter type studies. And the key thing is that, individuals need to understand that if those studies are done properly, patients, aren't at a disadvantage for either getting access to the vaccine or being thrown into the placebo group.
Mm-hmm. Great. And Dr. Ward, I understand that through your work at the MUHC's Vaccine Study Center, you're currently recruiting participants who want to be part of some of these COVID-19 trials, correct?
That's correct.
So can you tell us a little bit about what that would entail for people who want to participate and who should consider stepping up for this?
Well, all of the studies being done in Canada right now or being planned in Canada are at the phase one stage. So that early stage where we're focusing on young, healthy individuals. Most of the companies and groups that are moving towards the phase one trials are targeting 18 to somewhere between 40 and 55 years of age. And individuals with really no health problems whatsoever, not even history of health problems. So non-smokers, non-vapers, people who have a reasonable BMI, body mass index, and so on. We want the healthiest of the healthy to be enrolled in these studies initially so that we get a really good idea of how well the vaccine works in that young, healthy group. As we move forward and as the data are collected from these young, healthy individuals, we'll have a much better idea of which strategies are likely to work in older individuals and also younger individuals. And individuals who have medical conditions that are associated with very high risk. I guess the last thing that I'll say, and maybe Jonathan wants to say something about this as well, these vaccines any vaccine carries a risk that it might actually make things worse. There are a number of historical incidents of people designing vaccines, developing vaccines, giving them to small numbers of individuals, and finding out that when those individuals are exposed to the natural disease is actually worse. It's called vaccine-enhanced disease. In animal models of MERS and SARS-1, there was clear evidence of that possibly happening with coronavirus vaccines. And so all of the vaccine developers are looking at efficacy, so trying to develop a vaccine that will protect, and certainly trying to develop a vaccine that will not make things worse.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk for a minute. I do want to get to the alumni questions, but let me just talk briefly about the manufacturing and distribution. You referenced earlier, Dr. Ward, the fact that there are some companies that think they can produce up to 1 billion doses of this vaccine over the course of a year. And yet we're trying to vaccinate 7.8 billion people potentially with two doses. So how would that work? How would we be able to get enough medications, enough doses out to people, and who would get these doses first? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, very briefly, everybody is thinking about that now. And there have actually been some major power moves by companies or by countries around the world to try to attract companies that have the potential to produce a vaccine to produce it in that country for precisely that reason, that access will be to some extent controlled by where the vaccines are produced. Canada is quite lucky in that we have several companies and groups that have the ability to produce quite large numbers of doses in Canada. I would say the vast majority of countries in the world have no vaccine production capacity. So even while we can be relatively reassured that we will have one or more vaccines available to us, including those made by the company I work with, Medicago, that's not necessarily true for everybody around the world. I think that there are some really interesting and important questions around equity, both within countries and between countries.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kimmelman, I do want to get your take on that as well, maybe from a biomedical ethical standpoint. Where does that community stand on this sort of notion of, you know, fair, equitable, and inexpensive distribution of critical medications and vaccines?
Well, I don't know whether I can represent what, you know, the community of bioethicists would say. I can represent at least where I would approach this, or at least how I would go about this. I mean, number one, you know, there are clearly some communities that are probably harder hit by this pandemic than other communities. There are also some communities that are already disadvantaged even before COVID-19. And I think many moral philosophers would argue that those communities have a much stronger moral claim on early access than would be relatively advantaged communities. I'm not sure the geopolitics favors that sort of ethical proposition there, but I think that most moral philosophers would acknowledge that deprived communities have a much stronger moral claim on the fruits of these research efforts. I think there's another issue that I think is an interesting one that we need to really start thinking about, which is that if in fact the pandemic is beginning to extinguish or quell or get under control in high-income countries, and it's not under control in lower or middle-income countries like India, Brazil, et cetera, there's a good chance that a lot of the vaccine testing is going to be happening in these low and middle-income countries. That raises any number of important issues about equity in terms of access, if these countries are bearing some of the risks and burdens, and the fact that they're bearing those risks and burdens reflect that they are historically disadvantaged relative to advantaged countries. That, I think, gives them a really powerful and strong claim on getting early access to those interventions that were tested in those countries and making those, you know, those vaccines available in the countries where they're tested. So I think that, you know, this is something that we really need to start thinking about in research ethics, the area that I work in. We're often really attentive to the fairness with which the populations that, you know, that we test interventions in, the fairness of the match between those populations and the populations that are getting access to the treatments themselves.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you.
And just historically, that hasn't happened. So for example, the hepatitis B vaccines were demonstrated to work first in, among other places, Haiti. And it took almost 25 years for the effective hepatitis B vaccines to be used in universal programs in Haiti. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those social and geopolitical inequities clearly have had impact in the area of vaccines. It will be very interesting and important to make sure that doesn't happen in the current COVID crisis.
Great, well, thank you.
I'll just say really quickly to that, you know, in research ethics, people often talk about there's these three principles: respect for persons, beneficence, and justice. And justice is always sort of the, you know, the lonely orphan child of those three principles. I mean, people talk about it, but it's much more difficult in the political realities to actually operationalize those principles. And so, yeah, we always get informed consent from patients, that's respect for persons, but we don't always make sure there's equitable access to the interventions we test.
Yeah, excellent points, both of you. So let's get to some of the questions that were submitted to us from alumni earlier this week. We received many, many great questions, and I'll try to get through as many as we can in the time we have left today. If you do have a question, you can email us again at aoc@mcgill.ca, and we'll try to squeeze a few more in. Actually, I'm going to start with this one because we're talking about sort of countries and clinical trials. This one came in from Vivian Krieger. So she's asking, which country or countries would you start human trials, bearing in mind that you would need an area where there is a reasonably high incidence of COVID-19 to determine efficacy, and a place where one can be assured of good follow-up?
So that's a great question. To date, all of the clinical trials that have begun in the countries where the vaccines were developed. So the Chinese companies and groups that develop vaccines, their phase one and early phase two studies have been done in China, the same in the United States, the same in Europe, and the same will be the case in Canada. The phase two, three studies are much more likely to have the consideration of where the disease is most active, because the early phase one, phase two, you're looking at safety and the immune response, and that can be measured anywhere. Phase three studies, you're looking at efficacy, and to actually figure out if your vaccine is effective, you have to have active transmission of the disease. So just 2 or 3 days ago, the Oxford AstraZeneca group announced that they were going to do their phase three study in Brazil. And that is very logical. That's one of the places on the globe right now that has the most active transmission of the disease. By the time Medicago is ready to launch its phase two, three study, we will be actively looking at the areas of the world where the disease is being transmitted most actively. We will certainly include North American, possibly European study sites, but we will almost certainly include low and middle income study sites where there's active disease.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. Let's move on to this question we got from Timothy Murdoch. I guess I'll direct it to you again, Dr. Ward. He says, he's asking, what is the single biggest challenge that you and the global medical community is facing in developing the vaccine for COVID-19?
Lack of sleep.
Single biggest challenge. Lack of sleep.
We as a community, and I can certainly speak for the company that I'm working with, we are really working hard, and we're working in unusually difficult circumstances, where at this point, probably 2/3 of the people at the company are working from home, working remotely, and we are under enormous pressure to get a vaccine as fast as possible and to have it be as safe as possible. So I think the largest challenge right now is the maintaining scientific integrity at an unprecedented pace. The regulatory authorities are also, you know, they're used to working at a very nice, slow pace. I'm not being mean to regulators, right? They should move at a slow pace. They are also under enormous pressure right now to review these documents being submitted by companies, and they are enormous documents in absolute record time. What normally takes months, many months, we're seeing the regulatory authorities turn these around in weeks, sometimes days. And you're able to pick up the phone and talk to them or send them an email, which is usually completely not allowed.
Interesting. And I can certainly attest to Dr. Ward's lack of sleep. He and I have been exchanging emails for the last couple of weeks preparing for today. And most of the responses I get back usually land in my inbox between 4:30 and 5 a.m. So you're definitely keeping strange hours. Here's a question from Jonathan Bailey, specific, I guess, to Canada's place in this whole sort of vaccine development. So he's writing, as a graduate of McGill University and as a Canadian citizen, I am hopeful that Canada will play a major role in creating a COVID-19 vaccine. Question: where does Canada stand at present with respect to developing a vaccine? In other words, are we capable of playing a major international role, or will we take a backseat to the US, Britain, and other countries?
Well, as I said before, Jonathan can certainly pitch in. We are relatively lucky in that we have multiple groups that are moving candidate vaccines forward. Companies, academic groups, the National Research Council, VITO, the Vaccine and Infectious Diseases Organization in Saskatoon. So I think we will be well served. The government has already committed large amounts of money to developing vaccines in Canada for Canadians, but also has made a commitment to making those vaccines available internationally. So Canada has stepped up, I think, both in terms of domestic production of vaccine, but also in ensuring that there will be sufficient numbers of vaccines that Canada will be able to make a contribution. Obviously not as big as the contributions made by the United States, possibly China and Europe, but I think still disproportionate to our size in terms of population.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you wanted to jump in, Dr. Kimmelman, but if not, I do have the next question directly for you. So this one comes to us from Heather Sampson. So she writes, thank you for these great webinars each week. I think that was to me. So you're very welcome. It's our pleasure. The question for Dr. Kimmelman, it's a bit long, so bear with me. So she's writing that these vaccine protocols have to be submitted to research ethic boards for review and approval before proceeding. With very little, if any, scientific evidence to rely upon, how would you advise these board members to assess the value of the proposed research, whether there is scientific validity, whether there is fair participant selection, what is a favorable risk-benefit ratio, how the results will be delivered to the participants post-study, and of course, is there anything else you would suggest they look at? A lot to unpack there, but maybe you could just speak a little bit to the board reviews.
Sure, yeah, no problem. So just to, by way of background, anytime you do a clinical trial in patients, there's an independent committee called an IRB, also called an REB in Canada, that's going to be making sure the study has an ethical design. And so what Heather's question is about is sort of what kinds of factors these REBs ought to consider when they're deciding whether or not a trial is ethical. So I think with respect to value, relatively straightforward in principle. I mean, we've got clearly a public health crisis here. And so, you know, in principle, it's going to be relatively easy to demonstrate that a trial testing a vaccine is going to have social value. To me, one big question, I guess, that I would worry about or think about with value is making sure there's production capacity or something that's going to be a natural kind of handoff from the trial through to actual public health impact. With respect to validity, I guess you want to make sure that you have a well-powered study. There's a large sample size. You want to make sure there's good comparators, that the endpoints make a lot of sense. Those are the kinds of things you would think about. Fair participant selection, I think this gets back to what I was talking about locating studies in disadvantaged or low-income settings. You want to make sure that there is some kind of a clear plan to make these vaccines, if they're proven effective, available to those kinds of populations. That we're not just going to sort of build our medical advance here in high-income countries on the backs of disadvantage elsewhere. Favorable risk-benefit balance. There, I think you're going to be looking at the supporting evidence, the quality of the phase two studies, what the safety is, how much of a signal about potential promise you have from those phase two studies. Also, with risk-benefit, you're going to want to go into populations for which this is a reasonable risk-benefit balance. Some populations, this might be a better risk-benefit proposition for them than others. And in terms of the results being delivered, I think you want to make sure that there's a clear, credible plan for making the results immediately available or sort of promptly available to communities that need this information. I guess one thing that I am a little bit concerned about and I'm doing some writing about is this sort of science by press release. It's kind of tempting to issue a press release, we've got efficacy, we've got a positive signal, but then to wait, you know, weeks or months even to release all the information around the safety and secondary endpoints. And in my view, it's unethical to be doing a press conference if you're not prepared to come forward with at least all the secondary endpoints that you set out to measure in a clinical trial.
Mm-hmm. Great. So we got a question that came in actually while we were on air. So let me turn to it now. I think it's a great question. It comes from Michael Stern. So he's asking, is it possible for a positive antibody response to be neutralized by a second wave of the disease directed against the anti-vaccine antibodies? Dr. Ward, do you want to jump in on that one?
Read that last part of the question again.
So is it possible for a positive antibody response to be neutralized by a second wave of the disease directed against the anti-vaccine antibodies? I guess what he's saying is, if we develop a vaccine, will a second wave mutate enough perhaps to make that inefficient?
Okay, so that's actually a really, it's a good question, and I'll just unpack it in two parts. There are other human coronaviruses that circulate actively, four quite common ones that circulate all the time. They're regular childhood diseases. We're exposed to them every a couple of years, even as adults. Those coronaviruses mutate quite actively. So they change on a regular basis. And that's one of the reasons why we are, you know, we get these common colds. And they're all the same family of viruses, but they do mutate. So far, the SARS coronavirus 2 does not look like it's mutating very quickly. It's kind of remained genetically the same. So antibodies directed against the SARS coronavirus 2 are likely to mutate that virus as long as it remains the same. However, as large numbers of people become vaccinated or become immune because they've been exposed, it's entirely possible that this new coronavirus will follow the regular coronavirus pattern of becoming more genetically labile, which means that it will accumulate mutations. And that accumulation of mutations might make it more severe, but usually the history of viral infections is that they actually become less severe as they commingle, if you will, with the human population over a number of years. So it is possible that we will see this new coronavirus follow the same path and become less severe. However, for a couple of years, we may see it arrive in periodic outbreaks or seasonally, depending upon how quickly we can get vaccines out to the large majority of the population in the world. The second part, which I'll be very brief, is it's also possible that antibodies directed against one virus, in this case, the new SARS coronavirus, could make the disease with a heavily mutated coronavirus or another coronavirus worse. So the antibodies that recognize a new virus but do not neutralize it can, in some cases, make it worse. That's a pretty remote possibility in the current context, but I hope that answers the question that was asked.
Great, thank you. I think it did, and I hope, Mr. Stern, that we got that the gist of your question right there. Let's turn to a few more questions. We have a little bit of time left. And again, if you have any questions, you can send them into aoc@mcgill.ca. John Roston was asking about adjuvants. He says he's been reading a lot of media stories about potential vaccines requiring an adjuvant, which, if I understand correctly, is a pharmacological agent that's added to a vaccine to boost immune response. And you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but his question is, are there serious potential side effects to adjuvants? And would we therefore be better off choosing a vaccine that doesn't require one?
So first, hello, John. John was my neighbor for many years in Montreal. second, adjuvants are used in many, many vaccines. And you're right. Adjuvants are used for a number of purposes to promote a stronger immune response, or to direct the immune response in the way we want it to go for a particular organism, or even in some cases to reduce the amount of antigen necessary so that you can produce more doses of vaccine in a limited period of time. And that's what happened in Canada in 2009, 2010 with the pandemic H1N1 influenza. We actually used an adjuvant to allow us to produce many more doses of vaccine quickly. Anytime you add something to a vaccine, there could, as Jonathan has pointed out, be advantages and disadvantages to that formulation. And so you have to be quite careful to make sure that you do the appropriate safety testing. As a general rule, adjuvants make the vaccines more immunogenic, so they produce a stronger immune response, and often they make them a little more reactogenic, so they might hurt a little more or give you a bit of a higher fever. But it's a, again, it, like any intervention, it's a risk-benefit analysis.
Great. Thank you. Let's turn this one over to you, Dr. Kimmelman, this next question. It comes to us, it's about trials, and it comes to us from Tony Rybczynski. He's asking, what percentage of people in a clinical trial would need to contract COVID-19 for it to be statistically valid, noting that currently less than 1% of the population are confirmed to have contracted COVID?
Yeah, well, that's a question that's probably better directed towards a biostatistician. I mean, you know, you need events. You need a certain critical mass of events. So you need some people to seroconvert to be able to detect the benefit of a vaccine. And those, you know, trials that are event-based often really, really need very, very large populations to be able to detect those enough events in a relatively short period of time. So that's why I think that's part of the reason, one of many reasons why vaccine trials tend to be much, much larger than trials for cancer drugs and others. But, you know, I think Brian's probably in a better position to, you know, throw out numbers in terms of the number of events that you would need typically to be confident about a vaccine's efficacy. But I'll just say really quickly, it's also going to depend on what level of protection you are looking for in a vaccine. If you need a 90%, you're going to need fewer events than if you're trying to detect a 30%. But Brian, probably you should take this one.
I think we're all struggling to figure out what kind of study size we're going to need. But the WHO Solidarity Trial, which is an attempt to organize many of the manufacturers across the globe, is targeting an event-driven trial with 10,000 subjects per arm. And their threshold for what they consider to be a successful vaccine would be 50% protection. And they figure that with 10,000 people in each vaccine study arm, they would stop that arm at around 150 people who have the illness. And so if you're looking for 50% efficacy, the biostatisticians have estimated that that should give you enough power to be confident that this vaccine achieves that 50% protection level. And so I think that's a reasonable guess for the study size.
Great, thank you.
Obviously, a vaccine that's 95% protective will be able to demonstrate its efficacy much faster.
Great. So we've received quite a few questions, again, during this broadcast, as you're speaking, around this notion of there potentially being not one, but several vaccines that will make it through trials and be approved for use. So I'll turn to this one that came in from Dorothy Cotton. So she's asking, if there are many different vaccines, ultimately, does that mean that they will vary according to target audience? For example, will there be some vaccines better for older people, or are there different ways of reaching the same endpoint?
Well, my personal opinion is that that's almost certain to happen. You know, in life in general, one size does not fit all. And I think it's very likely that the different vaccines being used will prove to have greater or lesser benefit in certain populations. And possibly also the risk-benefit ratio might be very different. And I'll maybe create a scenario and then let Jonathan talk about it. But right now, people over the age of 75 have a very high risk of dying from COVID. In some cases, 10, 20%. If a vaccine proves to be effective, but for example, has a risk of 1 in 100,000 of causing severe disease, possibly even death, you could make a pretty good argument for using that vaccine in people over the age of 75, but it's a vaccine that you wouldn't use in 5-year-olds who don't die from the disease.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So we also received-
Just if I can say, you know, one of the things that I think is going to be a challenge is, given that there are lots of different vaccine candidates that are moving forward, having comparative information about those different vaccines, and sponsors are often pretty loath to test their vaccines head to head with other vaccine candidates. You know, it's a risk that your vaccine's not going to be as effective as the other. And so not only is it inefficient because we actually need more clinical trials to run, you know, to test each vaccine separately, but we also don't really have reliable information about how well these vaccines compare side to side, next to each other. So anyway, this is, I think, going to be another sort of challenge for the world of vaccination.
Great. So we received a question just now, let me put two questions together. One just came in and we received one a couple of days ago. So just now Mark has written to us and he's saying, given limited resources, wouldn't it make more sense to focus on developing treatments rather than vaccines? And earlier this week, Mike O'Brien wrote and he said, it's been 35 years now that we're still waiting for a vaccine for HIV. And yet HIV is now completely manageable and is no longer a major threat. How did this happen? And is there possible for a similar route for COVID-19? So maybe you can address the sort of focus on vaccines versus treatments, and maybe HIV is a good example, maybe not, I'm not sure.
Maybe I'll start, and Jonathan, you can finish. I finished up my professional training at Johns Hopkins as an AIDS fellow. a long, long time ago, 1989, 1990, as the first AIDS therapies were becoming available. And so that took several years for the first AIDS therapies to become available. And I don't think we would consider HIV AIDS to be controllable, certainly not easily controllable, for at least a decade and a half, possibly two decades after that. So there was a very long period of time when many people suffered a great deal from HIV before it was controllable. We do not have a vaccine for HIV, but HIV is a very different beast from this coronavirus. It's a much trickier organism genetically and its lifestyle. There's every reason to believe that we will be able to develop a highly effective vaccine, probably multiple highly effective vaccines against this coronavirus.
Great, thank you. We only a few more minutes left, but we're still getting quite a few questions. Maybe Dr. Kimmelman, you want to take this one. This one comes in from Norm Bailey David. He's asking, how much is profit motive playing a role in vaccine development? And will profitability have an impact on where the vaccine is distributed first?
Yeah, well, you know, I think Brian can probably give a good perspective on this because he's, you know, he's at a company. But, you know, by and large, most vaccine and, you know, drug development is happening within the private sector. Private sector is not there necessarily purely to serve public health and public objectives, although that may be a secondary goal for them, but they're there primarily to reward their shareholders. And so companies are going to go where the incentives are. Right now, if you have a vaccine and you're the first to deploy it, there's enormous money to be made given the enormous demand and you know, support for vaccine development. So yeah, I think it's really a matter of governments kind of shaping, given that we do much of the vaccine development in the private sector. There is some public sector work, but ultimately it's going to be the private sector that's going to be ramping up the production and, you know, deploying this. I think it's really critical that we devise incentive structures, reimbursement mechanisms that are going to really kind of encourage the private sector to do the kind of work, to develop the kinds of vaccines we need to address this broader public goal of, you know, controlling the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's have one last question. This one came in from Karen Altfest. So she's again question or asking a bit about what you had referred to earlier, Dr. Ward, the fact that you're saying that we could have a vaccine ready by the end of 2020, and yet we've talked about it taking 12 to 18 months to develop. So her question is, when did work actually begin on this vaccine?
Well, if you include the work that was being done on MERS, a closely related virus, the work began several years before, funded by an organization called CEPI, the Coalition for Emerging Pathogen Innovation. So in fact, a great deal of the basic science work for coronavirus vaccines had already been done. And so I know that the work on this new coronavirus, vaccines for this new coronavirus began the day after the Chinese released the genetic information. CEPI basically called up these groups that were already working on MERS and said, are you guys willing to switch? And we'll give you more money. And usually if somebody offers you more money, you say yes. But pretty much everyone else around the world who had a capability, including Medicago, we literally started discussing this the day after the Chinese released the genetic sequence information for this virus. January 11th, we can give you a specific date.
Okay, great. So I know we only have a couple of minutes left, and thank you again to all of our alumni who sent in such incredible questions today. I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to get to all of them. But let me just end with one final question to each of you. Again, if you can keep your answers, you know, brief if you could. And I guess it's really just looking ahead in terms of, like, we're looking back at what lessons were learned from this. So I know that obviously in the world of, you know, vaccine development, I mean, everybody was obviously caught off guard by this coronavirus, some more than others. And in theory, you can't really develop a vaccine without having the elements of the virus you are targeting in hand. But that said, I'm curious from each of you, are there any sort of broader lessons that we might take away from this crisis that might help us be better prepared for the next viral outbreak? Dr. Ward, do you want to start with that one?
I think so far the cooperation around the world has been remarkable. And I think that by using the whole world's expertise in a collaborative fashion, I think we are establishing a model that will serve us well globally for the next pandemic, because this is not the last, right? We've had Zika, we've had chikungunya, HIV, West Nile, now this coronavirus. This is not the last one. And so the work we're doing now to establish these global collaborations is going to be invaluable in the future.
Mm-hmm. Great. And Dr. Kimmelman, I'll give the last word to you.
Sure. I wish Brian had gone last, because Brian has a more sort of hopeful and optimistic outlook. I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from the way the science was handled in the first few months of this pandemic. There were a number of missteps. I think a lot of exposure about the lack of research preparedness. I think it's really important to recognize that research, the ability to mount clinical trials, to orchestrate them effectively, is really a critical part of any kind of public health response, as well as a healthcare system. And it's important, just like we need public healthcare systems to be prepared for pandemics, we also need our research systems to be prepared for them. We need ways to get researchers to cooperate and work really, really quickly together. And I think, the early part of this epidemic, maybe we've learned something about the perils of launching a lot of uncoordinated research efforts. Maybe things are a little bit more hopeful in the vaccine realm, but certainly in the therapeutic realm, I hope we've learned some lessons.
Great, great. Well, thank you. So that's not completely pessimistic, so that's all right. But next time I'll stick to alphabetical order for the end. So that about wraps up the time we do have today. Before we close, I would like to remind you that this video will be available at this very same link soon after our recording ends. So feel free to share it with others who may not have been able to tune in live. Please keep watching your email and social media feeds for more opportunities through this series and through other webinars offered by McGill's Alumni Relations team to learn about how McGill is confronting the challenges of COVID-19 and keeping you informed with insight from our academic and medical experts. If you're a McGill graduate who is not currently receiving our emails but would like to be added to our distribution list, you can visit alumni.mcgill.ca/register to sign up, and the link will be available beneath the video player on our YouTube channel. And of course, a big thank you to Drs. Brian Ward and Jonathan Kimmelman from McGill's Faculty of Medicine for sharing your time and knowledge with us today. I would also like to remind everyone watching today that you can still support the MI4 Emergency COVID-19 Research Fund that we referenced earlier in the broadcast.
Tandis que nous poursuivons la lutte contre la propagation de la COVID-19, de nouveaux programmes de soutien sont en place pour les personnes qui en ont besoin, notamment un régime d'assurance-emploi plus fort et plus accessible, ainsi que 3 nouvelles prestations de relance économique. Continuer à soutenir les Canadiens maintenant nous aidera à assurer notre sécurité et à rendre le Canada plus résilient. Consultez canada.ca/le-coronavirus pour en savoir plus sur les nouveaux programmes de soutien aux revenus. Un message du gouvernement du Canada. Thank you.